Welcome back, podcast listeners, and welcome to part two of our Outlast Odyssey. If by chance you missed our previous episode, we would highly recommend that you give that a listen first, as we'll no doubt be continuing discussions started in that episode. Today we'll be exploring Outlast 2, a somewhat divisive sequel amongst the fan base, and we want to explore what the cause of that was by piecing together what we know from our experience playing the game and any tidbits that we were able to pick up from the Murkoff Accounts comic series. So, if you're sitting comfortably, let the pilgrimage begin.
Hello, hello, one and all, and welcome back to another tantalizing, jam-packed episode of the Missing Manual podcast. Zach and Connor here once again, and we are going to be chatting about Outlast, and not just Outlast, Outlast 2, following up from our fantastic first episode, aren't we, Zach?
Yes, yeah, we were very, very excited to get stuck back in and continue the series. It's very, very good in the last episode, like I mentioned in the intro. If you haven't gone back to listen to that yet, would highly recommend, because we covered the first game, the DLC, and we were, like we said, mentioning the Murkoff Accounts comic series as well. We're going to be using that as reference again today to help us fill in the blanks. As we mentioned, Outlast 2, very, very divisive among the fan base. A lot of that is just down to how different it appears on the kind of the face value.
It is completely. So a little bit of a background before we jump into the meat and potatoes of the game. So Outlast 2, obviously, sequel to the original Outlast game. Not a direct sequel, mind you. It takes place in the same universe, but a different part of the world. So it's still the same universe. The events of the first game still exist, and all that kind of business. But this game is just in a different part of, you know, the Outlast mythos, basically. This game was obviously once again made by Red Barrels, and it came out in 2017. So it's not super old in the grand scheme of things, is it?
No, not at all. And actually playing the game, the graphics are really, really good, considering that it is on an older Unreal Engine.
It is actually really crazy, man. And it's good you say that as well, because genuinely it shook me when I first played it, because they are using at the time, semi-outdated version of the Unreal Engine. The old Unreal 3 engine, and it was obviously heavily modified for their, you know, for their purposes. But it was out of date, and they've made that game look really good. Outlast 2 looks fantastic, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. Yeah, yeah. I obviously playing it on the Steam Deck, I had all the settings cranked up to the top, so I could really give it a good whirl. And I have to admit, yeah, it looks really good. It stands like even by modern standards, you know, considering, you know, like you said, about 5 years ago this came out now. Still definitely stands up. And I mean, there are some things that I wish I hadn't seen in as much detail in that game, if I'm being completely honest with you. But there you go.
And obviously Outlast 2 on its own was a standalone product. It didn't receive any DLC, and there is a slight story to that. So there's a few mixed accounts online, basically. One of them have said that basically Outlast 2, it was never designed to have DLC. Outlast 1 apparently was always designed to have the whistleblower content come in, which I think is quite good, because they always had that on their mind. 2 wasn't. But there's also mixed opinions that I've seen online of people claim that sources from the studio state that Outlast 2 was structurally not compatible with DLC. The way they made it wouldn't have worked with DLC in mind.
Oh, okay.
Which is interesting. So it could be potentially a technical knock-on of using the old engine. I'm not too sure. Because obviously DLC is a bit of a complex beast for certain games and how it works. For certain live service games, obviously that DLC has to go into the game. The game has to then work, and it has to work for other people that don't necessarily have the same DLC as you. For single player games, it is a bit different, obviously, because it's just a single player game. It's not relying on anyone else.
But you have to make sure that it doesn't break the game that you're adding it to.
Yeah, and with Outlast 1, obviously, Outlast 2, Outlast Whistleblower features as like an extra campaign, but it still uses elements from the first game in it. And as we talk about Outlast 2 in kind of its story in that, I think it would be a little bit difficult, because the game is kind of a mad dash, isn't it, all the way through?
Yeah, honestly, it's one of those games where it is a mad blur from start to it. You're getting bombarded with so much that it's quite hard to keep track of it. Now, me personally, I think Outlast 2, story-wise, I think it may have benefited from some DLC, just for those people that aren't willing to go go off and read the comic series,
100%,
and for those that aren't willing to read between the lines, because there is nothing self-explanatory about this game. The first one still has its obviously hidden lore within the notes and the recordings and stuff like that. But I feel like for you to have any semblance of grasp on what's going on, those recordings and those notes are pretty vital for the second game.
100%, yeah. There's a lot of story in the second game which goes under the radar, and a lot of stuff which the game doesn't directly tell you. They kind of pull a bit of a Dark Souls here, where they kind of hide the lore and the information behind bits and bobs, and you have to kind of see through it, really. But also, you are kind of pulled into this world, and you're kind of it almost feels like you're losing your own mind by the end of the game, doesn't it?
Definitely. And it was one of those things where, like, I almost felt like they were pulling an Alien Covenant on me, where I had to do some homework about the game to actually understand it. So it was only because I had a little bit of prior knowledge about what had happened in the game before playing the game, because for those that don't know, I've only recently just played the game myself, so I had only watched videos of it up until very recently. Actually going in and playing it, I can completely understand why so many people lost their way with it and didn't get it, because nothing, like I said, nothing is self-explanatory. It's so difficult to try and unravel everything that you're getting bombarded with. It's a real mind bender. But again, like we've said, that's almost kind of like an artistic choice for Red Barrels. It's almost like the whole narrative was built that way for you almost as a way of getting you intrigued. So you want, you know, it's the old Starship Troopers meme, isn't it? Do you want to know more? Would you like to know more?
There is a lot of moments in this game where you find yourself like that. So Zach played through this game in a single day, didn't you?
Yeah.
When I first played through this game, I did like a weekend. I did like a Saturday, Sunday type thing and played through it over the course of a weekend. So it's not a long game, but also I don't think the original Outlast is a very long game either. That's the thing about these games. None of them are very long. Which is something, obviously, that's an interesting discussion point about Trials that we're going to get into a bit later on, and how Trials works as an entity, because Trials is very different. But enough about our rambling. Let's get into the meat and potatoes, shall we? Shall we deep dive this?
Definitely, yeah. So, I mean, we'll start with the player character. So, obviously, your kind of introduction, you're given, as you were with the first one, when you were introduced to the fact that you're playing as a gentleman called Miles Upshur. In this one, you're playing as Blake. So Blake Langerman and his wife, Lynn, is also there as well. Now, they are reporters, and they are investigating the murder of a Jane Doe, who was pregnant and killed in impossible circumstances. She was basically found wandering the desert. And there's obviously a mystery to unravel here. So they've hired themselves a helicopter, and they're flying over the area where the Jane Doe was found, in the middle of nowhere. Mm.
So that's a massive change up already, right? So we've gone from the first game, which is set up almost kind of Rocky Mountain air, isn't it? In Mount Massive Asylum, whereas this game is set in Arizona, and they've like desert area. So already we're seeing like a complete change of palette here, aren't we?
Yeah, it's a completely change of setting, almost immediately upon kind of getting into the gameplay. You're already getting a kind of an idea that things are more open. You know, there's a lot more space to move around in, but there's also a lot more places where danger can come from.
Mm. I do think actually the levels of Outlast 2, because quite a lot of the levels of Outlast 2 actually kind of feature outside, don't they? Outside elements. The world does seem a lot more open, a lot more kind of, it gives the illusion of almost like a free roam world, when it is linear like the first game. But I think those outside elements really push that kind of feeling, because Outlast 1 had outside elements, but they were very far and few between, apart from that section towards the later half of the game where you're outside for a bit of time, and that's spent mostly in darkness. Whereas this, obviously, a lot of the game is kind of set over a night again, just like in Outlast 1. And a lot of that is actually set outside, which is kind of cool.
It is, yeah. So, I mean, our kind of two brave reporters, you know, they're starting to get a shot in the helicopter before they even make it onto the ground. And I mean, even before that, your character is kind of woken up by the sound of screaming. There's a young girl. Mm. So already it's starting to get quite confusing here. There's a young girl screaming about somebody's coming after them, and your character springs awake and you're there, and Lynn's on the other side of the helicopter from you. Apparently you were talking in your sleep and talking about Jessica. The name Jessica crops up, and there's a little bit of a to and fro between the characters. You find out that this was a girl that they knew from their childhood, from being at school. And it's like, oh man, we haven't thought about her for an awful long time. Obviously at this point you're kind of thinking, why is that relevant to where we are at the moment? So they start shooting, start getting ready to kind of record their findings. Mm. And this bright white light just flashes up and disorients the pilot. The helicopter goes out of control, and the worst happens. You crash land in the middle of nowhere.
Which is really not what you want, especially where our man Blake has crash landed. So it's worth noting what Zach said there about the flash. The flash is very important, and the flash is going to be a concept that's introduced many times in the story. You know, and I feel like when you're playing this game, obviously, before we get into this a bit further, spoiler warning, we're going to talk about the entire game here. So if you don't want to hear, play the game first, then come back, listen to us ramble. And obviously, disclaimer, this game is pretty disturbing. And I think this game has a lot more themes in it that are probably more disturbing than some of the stuff in the first game as well.
Yeah, and that was a pretty high bar that the first game set anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I definitely found this one more harrowing to play. There aren't really many sensitive themes they don't touch on within the series anyway, but this one is this definitely takes it to another level, this game, and obviously we'll kind of cover that as we go along. But
oh yeah, there is some severe severe warnings for this game. There is some very very out there topics, and pretty crazy topics as well when it comes to games, because these are usually topics that you don't see in video games often. Even horror games don't do them, because it's just a ratings nightmare, basically. It should come as no surprise that this game did not receive a rating in Australia when it first came out.
Yeah, not surprising in the slightest.
No, it did not. And then a month before its release, they submitted it again, basically. And after that, it received a R18 plus rating, which apparently is the highest rating ever the Australian board can give a game or a product, basically. Which is kind of interesting.
I mean, Red Barrels are just going for Guinness Book of Records now. Just how many ratings can we break?
how many ratings can they not get through? Obviously, you know, this comes fresh off the information we spoke a few episodes ago about the Callisto Protocol, for example, as well, right? A game that has not made the ratings cut in Japan, rather interestingly enough.
Yeah, completely. And it's and again, I will kind of mirror what I said there. I do think that it's good that that there are developers out there that aren't afraid to broach sensitive subjects, you know, because if they're not covered, then we forget about them, don't we?
Exactly. And at the end of the day, this is a game. This is a media experience. You know, this is not a real life event.
Correct.
It's nothing like that. It is fiction. It's complete work of fiction. But yeah, it's impressive that a company like Red Barrels is out there pushing the limits of what they can put in a game before people are just like, oh, you know, completely put off of it.
exactly. It's an uncompromising vision, and it's adopting that kind of that attitude that if you don't want to play our games, that's fine. But
exactly,
this is here to stay. This is a part of the experience.
So Mr. Blake wakes up after his emergency landing in the Arizona desert. And finds the pilot. Unfortunately, our pilot man has not been so lucky. And in a scene that kind of mirrors the first game, actually, when Miles comes across a security guard strung up, our pilot is also sadly strung up. He's been crucified. And not just that, he's also been skinned alive, which is very cheerful.
Yeah, sadly, the pilot has no final warning to give you like the security guard did in the first one. He's long dead.
He is long. He has gone the way of the dodo, and someone has made an awful mess of him. But I do like the parody, and it's a very similar situation, because obviously at that point in the first game, you start to learn about, oh, if I record things as Miles, I get information. And this is also that same period in Outlast 2 as well, where you're told, record things, you'll get more information. And like Zach said, this is a very important mechanic in the second one, especially, because a lot of the game is very cryptic in places, and doing this can allow you a little bit more information on what's going on.
What's actually really, really good about Outlast 2 as well is that they actually take the recordings a step further.
Yeah.
So now you don't just get like a note to read off the back of the recording. You can actually watch the footage back that you have recorded. There are like set events that you record. There's like a red marker in the middle. And once that circle is complete, it's recorded the event. You can then go back and Blake offers like commentary on
almost like a director's cut kind of thing, doesn't he? Like,
correct,
he speaks over his own recording basically to provide a bit more sustenance and a bit more like explanation, really.
Yeah, this is good because it acts a little bit twofold, because it will help you understand what you've seen and your objectives at that particular point in time, but it also I think allows it almost gives you a little bit of a like milestones to the gradually degrading mental state of the player character as well.
Because just like our boy Miles, right? Blake isn't going to make it to the end of this completely in one piece.
No, definitely not. You know,
I actually really like that feature, though, man. It's good you touched on that with the recording things back, because I always thought, you know, an awesome mechanic for Outlast, it would be really cool. It would be very hard to do, and I don't really know how they do it without it being very obtrusive or very large, but I thought it'd be so fun if whenever the camera was up, yeah, like it was just recording you play as well at the same time, like recording what you do, and then at the end you basically have like a small movie almost of every time you had the camera up doing stuff.
That would be cool. Yeah,
like it would be super cool. It'd be kind of hard to do. I don't know how to do it, but like I found that would be a really cool thing to do, because imagine that, like it would incentivize like players having the camera up like more basically, and it would almost act like a little like I said, like a mini movie almost.
Yeah, I mean, but then again, depending on how long it took you to complete the game, and if you had the camera the whole time,
that's the problem.
You could have like a six-hour movie. Yeah, so
it'd
like
be good for speedrunning.
Oh yeah, completely agree. And I think that's why it's good they do it the way that they do, where you can have the camera up at all time, but it's on standby, and then you only record certain events. Obviously the camera comes on automatically when you're looking at something that is able to be recorded, and then when you go back to, even if you go back to the main menu, any recordings that you would have made are accessible from the menu, so you can watch. But we can watch those back. So, say for instance, when I completed the game, I was able to go back and I was able to look at all of the notes I collected. But then I was also able to look at all of the recordings I made, and it's actually me moving in real time in the game.
Yeah, that's what's really cool, right? So the almost the idea is there, but it's just for these clips. But it's you actually recording it, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's really quite cool the way they've done it, and I think they did that to the best of their ability. But you know, I'm totally with you. I think the full recording would be pretty good.
It'd be an interesting mode, interesting like sub mode they could do for the game maybe. But anyway, our man Blake wakes up, sees the pilot skinned, immediately panic sets in. His wife, the woman in the aircraft, is also gone as well. She's missing.
Yeah,
too.
Lynn
is gone. So Blake wanders his way through the desert, and he ends up in a nearby town, a town called Temple Gate. And it's here that he starts to meet the colourful folk of Temple Gate. And now these characters are very weird, very creepy people, and very reminiscent of the early stages of the first Outlast game, when Miles encounters the kind of the patients in the asylum that are kind of wandering around, but aren't really super hostile. That's what these guys kind of remind you of.
They're definitely leering in the darkness, though. You know, you can definitely sense that their intent is not friendly.
There is that creepy scene when you're walking through the town for the first time of Temple Gate, and it starts getting dark, basically, and you can see eyes in the distance, can't you?
Yeah.
Eyes over the fences. You can't see the people, but you see their eyes, and that's worse, because that was always a thing in the first Outlast that fucked me up the most, was seeing...
It's the cat's eyes, isn't it?
It's the cat's eyes, yeah. It's creepy as hell, man. Because you know there's a person there, but they're just watching you and they're not moving. And that's creepy as fuck.
Yeah, it is incredibly, incredibly creepy. And there's, you know, kind of outbuildings and little wooden shacks and bits and pieces like that. You know, you start picking up notes and batteries and you know, little bits and pieces here and there. And already you're starting to get an idea that something is very, very wrong in this place. There's... I think one of the first notes you pick up, there's this, it's an incredibly descriptive, I'm not going to obviously verbatim it, but it's quite graphic. And I think it's written by a woman, isn't it? And
yes.
She's talking about how, you know, it's basically that she is, lustful and ready to kill her children or something along those lines. Mm. It's very, very sinister.
It's quite wild.
Yeah, it's not a relaxing read, to say the least.
No. As Blake travels through this town and encounters these notes and these people, he begins to learn of a man called Father Roth. And this man is a very interesting man. His design is really cool, actually. I like how he looks and how they've modeled him. And Noth is a prophet, a messiah almost. And he's a leader he's the leader of this community known as Temple Gate. And as Blake kind of continues forward, looking for his wife, finding more of these things, he starts to learn about this man's obsession, basically, with the end times. So he's sort of like a cult, he's a cult leader, basically, almost very reminiscent of real life cults, actually. I'll touch on something a bit later about that.
Yeah.
And it's very creepy. So immediately we paint a completely different picture for this game. Miles found himself in the asylum. Blake finds himself in basically a cult compound almost.
Yeah. It's like a ranch, isn't it? Like a community
in the desert. Yeah. Like a religious commune. And Blake begins to learn basically that Noth is having and forcing a lot of his followers to have children, basically. But not just to have children, but to also kill their children.
To sacrifice them.
Yeah. Sacrifice their children in the name of the God, which is pretty, pretty wild. And there is a horrific scene that you come across in the early hours of the game with the floor. You know the bit I'm talking about, Zach?
Oh, yeah, the infant pit, right?
Yes. This is a thing that got a lot of notice when it first came out as well, for good reason. Yeah, you come across a pit of dead children, basically, and the light shining down on the pit, isn't it, Zach? The light
it's a crucifix.
In a crucifix, which is fantastic. Like, the set dressing is absolutely fantastic. It's picture perfect, but holy howl is it disgusting and disturbing.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, Noth's kind of vision is that... they sleep around, they create the children, they sacrifice the children because he believes that the Antichrist will come from his flock. So by killing those children, he is preventing the end of the world. He's preventing Judgment Day, which is just, it's bonkers. Like, everything about it is just ridiculous, right?
And exactly
the fact that you come across this pit very early on. It's a very striking image, and it's not just the image; it's also the sounds that go with it, because you have to walk through the pit, and it's the crunching and the squelching. Ooh, yeah. It's just very, ooh, very visceral. It's very, very. I use the word visceral quite a lot, right? And I feel like it's losing its value somewhat. But
no, this is harrowing shit.
Yeah, this is. It's not a pleasant experience.
No,
try and get through that as quickly as you possibly can.
The baby pit is very creepy, but it highlights the kind of environment that Blake finds himself in, and also the kind of person he's dealing with here. Noth is a religious zealot. He is absolutely bonkers and fanatical about his worship, and he uses this to get his own way in the cult. He allows him to, abuse the women in his cult. It allows him to convince them that they need to kill their children, basically, to stop this Antichrist from coming. And in doing so, Noth can still keep his kind of hold over the compound and keep the people under his thumb.
Fun little side note about him as well. This isn't something that you find out in the game, but this was something I found out from the external sources, like the Murkoff accounts. But Zach Sullivan Noth was actually he was a shoe salesman before he was a cult leader. So he had the gift of the gab, obviously, and... obviously decided to pack in selling shoes for a sex cult.
It's the next best thing, right?
I mean, it's certainly a markup, isn't it?
But so you used to sell lawnmowers, didn't you?
yeah.
Could you be a cult leader?
don't think I could be a cult leader. No.
So our man Blake eventually makes his way to a chapel in the compound, and that's where he first actually encounters the man himself, Mr. Noth. And also there is Lynn, his lovely wife, who's there. And Noth claims, basically, that Temple's Gate, the community, lies like on the middle of hell, like underneath it is hell itself. And Lynn, this outsider who's come into their flock, is pregnant with the Antichrist. And obviously, Blake's mind is also like running mile a minute. He saw Lynn not too long ago. She wasn't pregnant at all. She was, you know, completely fine. She looked normal, didn't she, Zach?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's it. Like, she certainly wasn't showing. So
she was not pregnant at all.
This is totally news to him. So he's, you know, he's kind of questioning now, you know, is she lying to me? Is there something that she's been meaning to tell me? You know, Noth over the tannoy, because there are speakers set up all the way around the settlement. He's kind of proclaiming that he made the inspection himself. He can tell that she's with child. She's brought the Antichrist into their sanctuary, basically.
Ooh, so that's a creepy man.
Very creepy man. So
yeah, his character design, he's like a big fat man. He's kind of got gout feet, huge swollen feet, huge like varicose vein legs as well. His character design is fantastic. Like, he looks really creepy and ugly and huge man. I also really like the kind of portraits you see of him around the facility as it's got a very nice art style, and the art style actually of the portrait is very similar to the art style of the comics.
Definitely is. And I always thought he kind of reminded me a little bit of like Oswald Cobblepot.
A little bit, yeah.
He's got a bit of a penguin look about him.
I feel like the penguin actually in comparison is a saint to this man.
You know, I'd be inclined to agree with you.
I would. Yeah, I think the penguin is a saint compared to...
At least the penguin would just shoot you in the face with an umbrella, right?
Compared to Sullivan Knopf.
Yeah.
So Blake escapes the chapel with Lynn in hand. They're running together. But Lynn can't keep up. You know, Lynn falters. She's suffering. She's not feeling very well. She's complaining of stomach cramps. Once again, this is sending alarm bells off, right, in the player. Oh, my God, Lynn, is she actually pregnant? Like, she's actually suffering here from, you know, pregnant things, right? As they're getting away, the couple end up being separated. You lose Lynn, and Lynn gets kidnapped by a splinter group. This is where the story takes a bit of an interesting dive, doesn't it, Zach? You learn that the cult, Heaven's Gate, basically, has like a civil war going on, don't they? They have almost like an infighting happening within the group.
They do, and they are called the Heretics. Now they take Lynn away. The imagery for them is quite strange as well. They're like they're very tribal in nature, and they've got like dried mud all over their body, and like sticks and twigs and stuff like that in embedded into their head, almost, isn't it? It almost looks like antlers,
like a Blair Witch almost. They look like Blair Witchy.
Yeah,
they've got like twigs and like twig witches, and yeah, they look very weird and very kind of shamanistic.
Yeah. So these heretics are outcasts. They've outcast themselves from the flock, from the kind of the followers of Noth, looking to bring about the Antichrist. So, you know, from Noth's kind of gospel, you know, what he preaches, they are the exact opposing force to his beliefs. And, you know, they believe that the birth of the Antichrist will bring about their salvation. Mm. They're very, very sick and twisted individuals. You know, they almost communicate in like guttural grunts rather than having like a fully fledged language. The only one among them that actually speaks is their leader, known as Val.
Mm. And Val plays a bit of an important role later on in the story as well. And her origins are also quite interesting. You can find out more about her origins from reading a lot of the lore that's scattered around. This is something that isn't really explained, but she at one point was one of Noth's bishops, almost like kind of second lead, not really like second in command, but like one of his like inner circle of like ministers. That kind of vibe is what she used to be.
Yeah.
But she grew very, you know, distrustful of Noth and kind of almost sick in herself, really, for allowing Noth to kind of get away with the stuff he was doing, which led to her having a massive question of faith and forming this almost renegade splinter group within the cult.
Yeah, she grew very bitter as well, because while children were still allowed within the cult, she was almost like their protector, their keeper. Mm. You know, when there were orphaned children within the commune, it was Val that took care of them. She was almost like a teacher and a guardian to them. So
exactly.
When it came time that the children had to go, it was left to her. And I think there was a part of her that was kind of broken off the back of that.
Exactly. And I think that's very clear. Like, by the time you see Val in this game, because obviously there's a lot of, just like the last one, right, there's a lot of prehistory that we don't see, but it's told through these documents. So that paints Val as a very different person to how you see her when you finally find her in this game. Now leader of this splinter group, the Heretics.
yeah, and her kind of belief is that the god that Noth preaches is not a false god. It's not real. It's not genuine. And that the god that the kind of the deity that she would believe in, she believes that it's true and it's within all of us. And it's that sin, isn't it? Yeah, it's absolutely like a retelling of the story between light and dark. It's
very much so, yeah.
Physical embodiment of it.
They play on a lot of classical religious tropes in this one as well, and a lot of religious stories that come up in many different religious texts, you know, from different faiths all around the world. They play on a lot of those stories in this game. So after the group come about, obviously they get broken up, they split up. The group, the satanic group, takes Lynn because obviously to them, Lynn apparently has the Antichrist inside her, so she's prime target. They capture her, take her away. You are rescued by a man called Ethan. No relation to Ethan Winters, obviously.
still can't get through an episode without mentioning Resident Evil.
No, we can't. We're going to keep doing it. And this Ethan man takes Blake and rescues him. And Ethan claims to be a man who left the cult, basically. And he is going to put Blake up for the time being. Just let him get his senses. Let him get together, basically.
There's an exchange between Ethan and Blake, which is quite interesting, though, because you find out that Ethan is actually the father of the Jane Doe. The reason why Blake and Lynn came to this settlement in the first place. And Blake has to do a kind of a terrible thing, but it's kind of almost a kindness to Ethan, and he has to lie because he knows that the Jane Doe is dead. His daughter is dead. But he has
Ethan claims that he got himself out of the cult, and before that he got her out of the cult as well.
Yeah, kind of spun them some lies and covered for her so she could make her escape. Kind of a little bit of a side note from this as well, just in case anybody is wondering how the girl died. This is actually explained again in the Murkoff Accounts comic series, and it is actually a Murkoff agent that is tasked with actually removing any witnesses, and the girl obviously is a witness. Mm-hmm. Now, having actually read the Murkoff accounts at this point, you start to actually to see where things are starting to tie together between the first and the second, because the second game gives you no indication that there's any real link other than the fact that it's,
right? Yeah. And to be fair, slight spoiler for the end of our discussion, we're going to get into it when we get to it though, but it doesn't really for the entire game, does it?
No, it doesn't. It does leave you wondering the whole time, is this actually going to tie in to the first one at all? There's no real evidence other than the title that it's even the same universe altogether, right? So once you've had a look at the Murkoff accounts, you start to see where things are tying together. And this
is put two and two together, don't you?
Yeah, it's the first real link is Ethan and his daughter, and I think they're called the Pauls, aren't they?
The Pauls.
The two agents. But yeah, one of them kills the daughter. I think they OD her in the hospital bed or something like that.
Yeah.
So try and cover it up, basically. But this is the first link that we have, but it's not seen within the game. So we are again
external media.
Yeah, so we are going to try and tie it in where we can. But at the moment, if you were just playing the game, if you played the first one and then you came onto this one, you'd have no idea that there's a link there at all, really. Mm.
So Blake, as he's resting with Ethan, basically, he goes through some bits and bobs and some kind of dream sequences. So it's worth noting that throughout the entire portion of the game, basically, Blake sort of suffers from these sort of breakdown moments where he is teleported back to a school environment, and it plays certain events from his childhood again, relating to Lynn and relating to a friend of his, Jessica. You touched on it at the start, didn't you, Zach?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so yeah. you start to get these weird kind of hallucination sequences where you're, like you said, back in a school, and starting to get the impression that this is like Blake's past coming back to haunt him.
And this happens quite a lot, doesn't it? And I always think the transitions were quite cool because it would drag you into the school environment, and all of a sudden you could go through a door and you're back in the real world again, aren't you? You're back
in the temple. Seamless.
It's seamless. Yeah. And it's fantastic to see because you were not taking the action for a minute, and you start to kind of view these school sections with a sense of dread. I always did anyway, because every time I got to them, I was like, oh, God, I don't want to be back here again, man, fuck.
Yeah, and that's the thing, like, you're absolutely correct there. And they become more frequent as time goes on, and the segments get longer.
Yeah, they do. It starts very short, very, very short, and it does go to it goes a lot further. So he has a bit of this moment when he's in the house. Sadly, Blake can't relax. You know, he's woken up by Marta, who's another key figure of the game. And Marta is sick. I love her design. I think her design is fantastic. Marta is a big old imposing, creepy woman who carries around a huge pickaxe. Like, she looks almost like a Resident Evil villain, doesn't she? Like Resident Evil boss. Definitely.
Yeah, yeah, like shades of the Executioner from Resident Evil 5, for sure.
That's the vibe I got when I first saw her. I was like, she looks like Resi 5 kind of vile, doesn't she? Like that kind of evil, creepy, big old boss kind of vibe.
Yeah, you know, draped in black rags and wielding this crucifix-shaped pickaxe, you know, with this kind of like incense burning in the top of it. It's a really, yeah, like you said, very, very cool character design, but really she's not cool to be trifled with. I mean, she basically can just insta-kill you. Anytime she's around, she'll just fucking body you.
She is the, she is like almost a variant, isn't she, of this one?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. She's
the Chris Walker of this game.
Definitely the Chris Walker of this game, you know. Yeah. It's very, very kind of lumbering, but also quite speedy in some areas. Mm. And, yeah, like just able to tear you limb from limb in a moment's notice. And it's like killing for Marta is like, and I don't think it's any coincidence that her name is Marta, and it obviously spelt differently to a Marta.
A Marta, yeah.
But I do think that there is some significance in the name, because she is faithful to Noth's creed, but it's almost like she herself is an outcast, and it's like killing is just part of the faith for her. It's like if she's not killing, it's not, you know, she's sinning by not killing.
Here I go killing again.
Exactly. And it's even written in a letter that you find from Noth to her. And he is like, do not feel bad about killing. Killing for you is not a sin. Not killing is a sin. You know, he draws reference to sloth, which is obviously one of the seven deadly sins, and how sloth is the great killer in our world. And by her killing and slaying people, she may save many lives down the road. So it's almost like he kind of almost goads her and wills her to carry on her kind of murderous tendencies. In some way, seeing it as God's purpose, which is, yeah, like, wow, blows your mind.
bigger purpose. And obviously in those letters as well, it is revealed that Marta is one of Noth's like executioners, basically like head henchmen to sort stuff out when stuff goes awry within the cult. And obviously you're probably thinking, oh, you know, why does Noth need an executioner? Well, it's like, obviously with the Civil War and whatnot, right? There's reason that he needs to kind of control his flock with a bit more firmness.
Yeah, definitely. And he is, he by his own admission within the notes that you find again, he's groomed Marta from a very, very young age for this purpose.
Yeah, she has become like this assassin contract killer almost, who shows up and kills enemies of Noth. And that is unfortunately what happens to Mr. Ethan. Ethan does get stabbed. He gets proper slabbed, mate, doesn't he, with the pickaxe?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He gets dropped.
which
prompts our man Blake into a bit of a run sequence where you're running away from Marta. You're going back and forth. That's quite a cool bit, though. I quite like the bit where you're going away from her through the cornfields. There's like a nice cornfield section where you're kind of chasing, being chased through cornfields as you're running towards another chapel within the community.
I also like a little segment just before that where you're on like a lake bed or like a river bed, and you can that's another great feature I thought that was good that they added to the game as well, is that you can actually hide under the water.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah,
obviously it's a limited time thing, because you obviously don't want to suffocate and drown, but it's again another layer that they've added to the game that wasn't in the first one, mostly just because there weren't any large water features, or not many large water features that you could utilize in the first game. Whereas, because there's obviously this is a little bit more natural, there are a lot of segments where you're in and around water and you can use it to your advantage. Even barrels filled with water.
Yeah, you can jump in and just hide in there for a little bit, can't you?
Yeah, definitely. So, like you said, very, very cool segments where you're trying to evade this big lumbering figure. You've also got the faithful looking for you as well. They're out there with the flashlights.
Yeah, yeah, it's well noted. Yeah, it's not just Marta who's looking for you. The faithful of Nofa are also searching for you with their torches and their smaller weapons, which makes it a bit harder because not only are you hiding from, you know, Marta, you're also hiding from these little guys as well. And you don't want them to find you because you don't want them to call Marta over. You know,
that's the real
bad shit there. So after getting through the cornfields, the rivers and the mini forests, our man Blake finds himself in front of another chapel. And inside the chapel, he finds a heretic who's been tortured. And this heretic basically claims that Lynn was taken to the mines that are near the temple gate. And the mines are where the heretics have sort of established their base of operations away from Noth and away from Noth's watchful eye. Blake obviously sets off, heads towards the mines, but once again, it doesn't go very well for him. And he gets captured and ends up in the forest again.
Yeah, so he's just going through a perpetual cycle of being captured at this point, isn't it? Is this at the point where he meets the Scald?
Yeah, he meets the Scald, which is sort of like a, I guess, like an unofficial third faction of the cult.
Yeah, now these are what we would probably describe as the unfortunate sufferers of the, they're the byproduct of the cult. They are, you know, or rather that they once were members of Sullivan's flock, but they're suffering from all manner of disease, mostly syphilis, gonorrhea, and they've been cast out for being sinners and as unworthy. Noth kind of proclaims that their sickness is one of the soul and not of the body.
It's almost like a leprosy colony, isn't it? Almost like a leper commune.
Yeah, absolutely. Like it's a really horrible experience to walk through the Scald settlement.
The whole section is just horrifically creepy and just dirty and grimy. And the people in there, they don't really try to attack you either, but they just look messed up. Like they've got like body parts are missing from them. They've got gouges in their skin. You know, some of them are missing their bits of their face, like almost like leprosy, right? Like their face is falling off.
Yeah.
Like their nose is gone. Their lips are gone. Like really kind of creepy. Obviously in the first Outlast we had a big influence on kind of man-made horror, you know, people who have been mutilated through surgeries and stuff like that, or self-mutilation. In this game we have people claimed by disease and by illness, by sickness.
Yeah, and the fact that Noth has basically just kind of thrown them into a pit and said, you know, your faith isn't strong enough. When your faith is strong enough you can return, you know, knowing that can never happen because what they actually need is penicillin.
Yeah,
they need modern medicine.
No holistic medicine business here. These guys need drugs. These antiseptic wipes and drugs, dude.
So the Scald, I think, are probably the most interesting of the three groups.
The saddest opinion. Of the groups as well.
They're definitely the saddest, but they are led by a kind of a duo, a pair. A double act, and they remind me just too much of Master Blaster from Mad Max Thunderdome. Right,
they remind me too much of Ferator from Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, same deal. But it's Nick and Layard. So you have this kind of smaller gent sat on the back of this big lumbering kind of brute, and Nick and Layard are like they're like the kind of the prophets of the Scald. They are the leaders, and they guide the lost in their kind of penance and their kind of return to the flock, even though it's never going to be an option because they're all afflicted and nothing that won't change. Not through faith anyway. Not for these poor souls.
No. And obviously they come across Mr. Blake, capture him, and proceed to crucify him, don't they?
Believing that he's again like an apostle, very very similar to the father from the first Outlast.
It mirrors it quite a lot, obviously. Like he Father Martin referred to Miles as the Messiah, you know, he would document his rise, and these guys see Blake is very much the same way. They call him a Messiah and they say, oh, you know, he's a Messiah of the modern times, because a modern time Messiah wouldn't carry a book, he'd carry a camera. Right.
Correct.
He'd film the deliverance. He wouldn't carry a scripture. He would carry a camera. He'd be the, you know, he would be his his messiah. So they basically pin him to a cross, which is quite a graphic scene as well, actually, isn't it? It's one of the very first person watching Blake get his hands nailed into a cross, basically, which is pretty horrific.
Every time they hammer on the nail and you get that red flash on the screen and it's like the searing pain, you can almost feel it, like phantom pain.
It really hit, like they really impact, like him banging in the nails. Blake obviously eventually gets off this cross and they do a sort of Outlast 1 vibe again, don't they, where they kind of give him permanent damage, so he has bandages around his hands for the rest of the game wherever the nails went.
Yeah, I have to admit, like when before he applies the bandages and you get the close up of the hands, that's a very graphic bit, and it's
very graphic, like, isn't it?
The torn bits of skin, and yeah, like it's very, very gruesome, very, very nasty.
And obviously, before Blake makes his exit, the Scald, the followers, actually they turn on their old leader, don't they?
Yes, yeah, that's it. Just as he's about to escape, he uses a rope to escape down like a trap door, doesn't he? And Nick and Laird are just about to stop them, and the Scald kind of cast them out, almost like you've kind of forsaken them. They've led them to nowhere, to ruin, basically. So they off Nick and Laird, and they get pushed down the hole and killed by the fall.
And this is where things start to take a bit of a turn. So Blake continues his journey onto the mines, obviously, to try and find Lynn, badly beaten, badly bruised, holes in his hand. He obviously starts suffering from more of these visions, these hallucinations of his kind of upbringing in this Catholic school. And throughout this, basically, as Zach said, right, these sections have started to get longer and a bit more ornate. And as you've been going through them, this is why I don't like going back to this section, is while Blake is in these sections, not only does he sort of represent, and he is a child because he's smaller as well, there's something following him. There's this creature, this horrendous demon chasing him, isn't there?
Yeah, and it's got like a split jaw, and its torso is made up of so there is torso there, but there's also multiple arms that are kind of like...
He's got like hands fully, that are like holding his body, isn't it?
Yeah, like, and not all of the arms are fully developed, but they're like folded in on his form to kind of form the torso. So this creature's made up of it's lots of hands and tongues primarily, isn't it? Yeah.
That's the thing. He's got his main kind of thing apart from his hands is obviously his face. He's got a jaw which is kind of hanging, and an extremely long tongue which is kind of coming out and kind of dripping across the ground. And it's his tongue that features in a few sections of the game. There's a bit obviously where there's a well that Blake comes across, and a tongue comes out the well and drags him down the well. He's crawling up a vent and the tongue grabs his leg to try and pull him back in. And it's just, it's so fucking creepy, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. The monster design for that creature, whatever it is it very, very, very impressive. Very scary.
It's super good. Like, it's so cool looking, and it's creepy as fuck. But it also relates to things in the storyline very well and very heavily. So as you're obviously experiencing these kind of hallucinations, you're introduced more to this character of Jessica, who is a childhood friend of both Blake and Lynn's. And basically something happened one day after school at the Catholic school he went to, and Jessica died of an apparent suicide. Blake came and found her on the floor with her face kind of all messed up and her neck broken at the bottom of a staircase.
Yeah, yeah. And frequently throughout the school segments, and even a few times it bleeds into reality, you get imagery of her hung by the neck by a rope.
Quite a lot, you know. So once again, not shying away from showing actual child death in this game.
Yeah.
You very regularly do see, like Zach said, Jessica's body hanging in sections, both inside and outside the school sections. And usually it's a precursor that you're going to, you know, go into a school section shortly.
Yeah. And one segment that I did, I found was particularly good. I thought it was very, very effective in the way that they presented it. It's the bit, do you remember the bit where you've got the computer banks in the library? There's one of the screens kind of flashes up and you go over to investigate it, and it's like it's got like a rudimentary kind of like MSN like a messenger system on there.
Like an old school Windows one.
And you're all logged in, you can see the usernames on there. Jessica's one, Lynn is one, and you are one, Blake as well. And you're typing in there, you're talking to Jessica, and it's like, oh, and she types in and she's like, oh, that's so weird, I can see you. And look behind you, and you're like, Oh no! And, you have this feature obviously in the game where you can we can push a button. I was using the Steam Deck, so it was a bumper button for me,
yeah,
the left bumper. And I looked back over my shoulder, and she was there, hung from the ceiling.
It's fucking proper crazy. Like the school sections, a lot of people give the school sections a lot of shit because they are kind of laborious and they do kind of go on. And, you know, for everyone, the kind of rinse and repeat cliches in there are a little bit tiresome, like hiding from the demon, getting to the end. But the school sections tell a very engrossing story that sets up a lot of what makes Outlast 2 creepy and scary. And it explains more about Blake than you're told otherwise.
Yeah, yeah, it does. It's one of those things where you can... It's almost like experiencing two separate horror games at once. That's probably the best way I could describe it, is that it almost feels like you're playing two different horror games at the same time.
Exactly.
And you kind of hop swapping between the two. Now, that is incredibly jarring, I would imagine, for somebody that obviously doesn't have any kind of background information on that. Again, like I said, I was a little bit better equipped to tackle that scenario because I knew a little bit about the game through seeing videos and doing a bit of research on it before I went in to play the game. So I was at least, I had half the story there, and then it was just kind of me experiencing it for myself.
You were already there like a bit, weren't you? But like that is why I think a lot of people get confused, because a lot of Blake's kind of background, a lot of his story is explained through the school sections. So you really have to pay attention when you're in these school sections, basically, or you're just not going to understand bits and bobs. And as we go further into it, obviously, we are introduced to a new character, a very important character, a priest who works at the school, whose name is Father, it's like Lutamish, isn't it? Or Lutamash. Lutamish?
Yeah, I couldn't confidently pronounce it.
It's a bit of a weird pronunciation. It's like Lutamish, Lutamash, something like that.
So but, what we'll do, for ease, we'll call him Father L.
Father L. And Father L is a character, a priest who works at the school as a music teacher. At this Catholic school that Blake goes to. And after, you know, you get close to the end of the game, Blake is in these hallucinations a lot more often, basically. You find out that this father was, he was a bit of a bad man, wasn't he, Zach? He was a little bit of a touchy-feely man.
There is a particular segment of the game, it is towards the end, but part of the school segment, and he is trying to separate you and Jessica, and you know everything about it is wrong.
Not good. Everything about the situation is not good. And obviously at the time, Blake is a kid as well, right? And he is being manipulated by the father to get away from Jessica. And
doesn't really understand completely, but kind of knows that something isn't right.
It's not right, no. Jessica is begging for Blake to stay with her. The father is like, you don't want this, you don't need to be involved in this, just go away, go home. Don't want me to tell your parents, that kind of thing. And obviously takes Jessica away from Blake. And this is where you start to put more and more together. As Blake gets closer to the mines, these start to crescendo up, don't they? And all the kind of revelations of this section come to light, don't they?
Yeah. So, you know, you begin, as you said, to understand Blake's kind of mental state. He's obviously got some past trauma here that's being tapped into by, and it's being triggered again by the trauma of the current situation. He's just reliving it all again. And, you know, obviously as a child witnessing one of his closest friends dying, you know, and then being confused by the situation by being told it's all in your mind. You know, she committed suicide. It wasn't what it seemed. She was obviously pushed down the stairs, right? She was pushed by this father, and then by Blake being manipulated, his whole faith and his whole belief system has just kind of unraveled.
Almost
like it's been held together by super glue this whole time, and then this trauma has just cracked it wide open again.
Exactly. But Blake blames himself. Even though he was a child, he blames himself for what happened to Jessica. Jessica is obviously, you know, revealed that Jessica was molested by the father and then eventually murdered by the father in an act to cover it up. He claimed it was suicide and sort of gaslighted Blake as a kid into believing that that was the case to kind of back up his theory, and so, you know, he wouldn't face trauma over it. There's obviously a lot of other stories and emails you can read in these sections that kind of allude to Jess being a bit of a rogue child and at risk of running away from the school and running away from her home and being a bit of a rebellious one. So they put two and two together, and obviously they could quickly, he could quickly tie it up by saying, no, she committed suicide.
And they covered it over and obviously then able to get away with it, which is... and it's horrendous to be a part of that and to experience that from a first person experience.
Oh yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah, that's almost, I would say, the most uncomfortable part about the game.
It deals with quite heavy and also quite real life issues, you know.
Yeah,
and that makes you think. I think as a player, it really puts like a bit of a moral compass in your direction, you know, to make sort of a decision and to kind of acknowledge these things. And obviously, putting two and two together, the demon's design is based off of the father, based off of the priest. The hands are, you know, relevant to kind of the touching and the feeling and the molesting the priest would do. The fact he has his massive tongue, all that kind of stuff is relating to a priest. So the demon's design mirrors the priest perfectly, and it's how Blake sees the priest.
Yeah, and again, it's only when you've got all of the pieces at the end of the game that you kind of figure that out. So just having this imposing kind of demonic being chasing you around a school, it's you know, without that context there initially, it's very jarring, but it's also incredibly terrifying because you just don't know where it's coming from. You just don't know what's going on.
And obviously this is where you also start to pick up on other theories. So every time Blake goes into one of these kind of moments, you see a flash on the screen, don't you? A flash of white light. Very similar to the flash of white light you saw at the very start of the game when the Blake's helicopter crashed. And this is prevalent throughout the game. And whenever these happen, usually things start to go a bit awry in your surroundings. But not just for Blake, for the other people as well, don't they?
Yeah. You can see that the other characters are actually being affected by it. There's a scene quite early on in the game when you see one of the, I think it's maybe the second flash of light that you see. And... All the people around you are like wailing and they're disoriented, and they appear to just be in this bewildered state.
And they're all saying different things as well, almost like their own, having their like their own experiences.
Yeah, and with the bright light as well, I think it's quite important to mention as well that there is a sound. Like a war horn being blown, and I feel like this is kind of quite rife with kind of that religious undertone again, because it's a little bit like the horn of heaven, you know,
the big horn,
the horn that would be sounded when the angels would go to war.
Mm.
It's all very deeply seated within this kind of religious undertone.
And obviously, like Knopf says, right, in his scriptures, a lot of the scriptures you pick up in the game and a lot of the characters will talk about the apocalypse and the end times and how they're coming. And you'll start seeing these kind of events happening as the kind of flashes are going off, and you're almost starting to believe yourself, aren't you? There's a bit just before you go to the mines where Blake gets on a little like raft, and flash happens again. And all of the fish from the lake come up to the top dead. And he's like, it's the apocalypse, is what it said, you know, all the animals are dying, you know, it's what Knopf said. So Blake almost in the end, and close to the end, finds himself believing what Knopf is saying.
Yeah. The plague of locust as well is also a part of that as well.
Exactly.
But it's worth noting that the lake segment, you actually start to get a little bit of, and again, for most people, this would have no, you would have no or context for it, but there's a tower in the distance.
Very faint, but a tower. And it's interesting because the game sort of shows you it, but it doesn't really do anything else with it, does it? It sort of just lets you be like the tower in the distance. And it's interesting to note because up to that point, that's kind of the first bit of modern life you've seen, ain't you? Like everything else in the Temple's Gate community is obviously kind of old school, not super old school, but it's not very modern. You know, it's very Wild West living, isn't it? Almost like commune you live in. And this tower with the lights on it kind of represents the first kind of thing you see that's a bit like the outside world exists, you know?
Yeah, and it's completely bizarre as well, because you never go to the tower, you never get really close to it.
That's literally the only time you see it.
What we'll do is we'll hold that thought and we'll talk about the tower
Put a pin in it. Hold that.
Put a pin in that for now, because I feel like once we've been through the story and we've explained it, we can then come back to the tower and we can really, really explain what's going on.
So after all this trauma, the realization of Blake's childhood, the issues he faced, and also Father L's deception, Blake finally reaches the mines. He gets to the mines. He finds the Heretics' underground temple, and he finds Lynn, his wife, tied up. And at this point, Lynn is visibly pregnant. Like, she is. She's about to burst, ain't she, man? She is proper pregnant.
Yeah, and it's impossible. Like, how could she have grown in such a short period of time? Like, it's just, there's no way. It's unnatural. It's
not right. Like, there's no physical way she could be like this. Because once again, just like in Outlast 1, this sort of takes place over a night's events, right? So there's just no way, like, that this has happened. Obviously, as this happened, the heretics are worshipping her, and all kind of chaos breaks out as Noth's followers also storm the mine, don't they?
Yeah, and there's this kind of all-out war underground.
Between both of the factions going at each other.
Again, light and dark coming together, in a massive, a clash of ages almost, between the followers of both sides. Mm-hmm. So in the chaos, it's time for Blake and for Lynn to get the heck out of there.
Slip out of that business.
Far away from all of this madness as they possibly can, because the child's on its way.
Child's happening. Like, your wife is pregnant. She is going to give birth. And Blake finds himself in another situation when he leaves with her. He finds that the apocalypse Noth is talking about may very well have arrived. Bad stuff starts happening. We've had the fish dying. The sky starts raining blood, which is the best part of the game, by the way. Because I was like, this is metal as fuck, man. Holy shit. Like, the effects they use for that are super cool as well. Because you kind of come out like a school section, don't you? And like, the fire at the extinguishers, sprinklers, that's the word, like spitting out blood, aren't they? And you kind of get out, and then real world mirrors it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, really, really cool. And again, like we said, with the seamless transitions, there's no loading screens in between this at all.
No, it's just one
flowing game.
One cut all the way through.
Yeah.
Which is amazing, which is fantastic. Also sort of what Dead Space did as well, one cut, you know. And it's awesome. Like, the rain and blood section is crazy because it changes the environment so much. Like, the world takes on a red hue, red light. There's blood coming down outside. The rivers are turning to blood. Everything is like completely different, isn't it?
Yeah. It's exactly like it's written in the Bible, you know. This is absolutely, you're seeing the end of days through Blake's eyes. Mm.
As the rain kind of pilters off, dawn starts to break, and as dawn comes in, a huge fucking storm then just comes through, doesn't it? Lightning storm, wind, and this bit is crazy because you're like running with your wife, you're ducking and diving, you're almost trying to dodge the elements, aren't you, at this point? Not even the crazy people, you're trying to dodge the elements itself.
Yeah, and that's not without one last final hurrah from Martha as well, because obviously she begins to chase you through the storm, and it gets very, very hairy, and you think, oh, this is it. Like, you're about to be killed by her. And then she is actually, she's just impaled on this giant like fork, basically. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She gets done in, doesn't she, by like a crucifix, like a cross almost impales her, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
From and the it top just of the chapel.
Straight through her and takes her out.
Which is crazy. And also really poetic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, she dies a martyr. For what she believes in.
That's so what you again, did there, man. That was good.
Exactly. Like it, that's why the naming is so clever. That's why I was saying, like, it's really clever the way that they did that, because it all comes full circle. All of the characters kind of get theirs, don't they? You know,
everybody
gets their just desserts. Obviously Martha gets slapped. You make it to the chapel.
You make it back to the main chapel where you got Lynn out of earlier. The big chapel on the hill. You get into the chapel away from the storm. The chapel has managed to survive the storm, luckily, and you lay Lynn down. Lynn then gives birth to a child that you hold.
And you see the birth in full detail.
You see the birth in full detail, yeah. You also hold the bloody baby in your hands after, which is fantastically modelled. But
no umbilical cord, though.
Pretty horrific, yeah. You see this child, to which Lynn describes, there's nothing there, and presumably passes away. And then Blake himself also passes out, doesn't he, holding the child.
Yeah it's a weird one, that, isn't it?
It is a very weird one, but hold that thought again, put another pin in that section as well. We're gonna backtrack. We're almost
Blake,
there
Blake comes to and Father Noth sat there on one of the pews, And
surprisingly, a pew that can fit his fucking large ass.
Yes. Yeah. And
I can't get around, guys. You see, this man is thick. He is huge.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's
a big boy.
He's a plus size lad for sure. But he is. He sat there and he's saying how, you know, that's the child, isn't it? I'm powerless to it now.
He sees the child. If you look down, Blake is also holding the child, now bundled up in a little bit of cloth, bundle of cloth.
Conveniently cleaned up. How did he manage that in his sleep?
All cleaned up as well. He's a sleepwalker. You know, he just gets a lot done.
He's a sleep changer.
Sleep changer.
Yeah.
Noff claims, obviously, he's powerless. The Antichrist is here. Blake holds the Antichrist in his hand. He claims that he had to kill all of his followers because of this. And then he implores Blake to kill the child before killing himself. He takes a blade and slits his own throat in front of Blake.
Yeah, and that's the end of Noth. Yeah, the end of the madness.
Boy.
And the cult has kind of come to a close. And
the
at
cult
that point.
Is by all means collapsed. Blake walks out of the church to see chaos around him. Tables and stuff have been erected with bottles on them and drinks on them, and around these tables are many, many people, dead people, and the cultists have all killed themselves in preparation for the apocalypse coming. They've already taken their own lives to not be taken by the oncoming apocalypse. At this point, Blake kind of looks up, and in the distance he sees the sun, and the sun suddenly grows crazy bright, crazy large, and his entire vision is just engulfed by the sun. And it fades to black. And he has one kind of last vision after the sun has seemingly absorbed him and destroyed the world of Jessica running through the school, basically, and him sitting down with her and talking and her promising that she'd never let him go.
And then the credits roll. And that's all you get.
And that's all you get.
So, you know, you're on the surface, then you're sat there and you're thinking, what the hell did I just witness? What did I just watch there? Like, what? Like, how does this relate to the first one?
It's what a very happened?
Did the world
ending.
Actually did the world actually explode? Was the Antichrist real? Like, you have all these questions that aren't answered.
Yeah,
at this point.
It's all very here and there, and you don't really know what's going on at all. Is the world actually ended? These supernatural things are actually real. The apocalypse has come too, and this is where the game, once like I said, doesn't really tell you anything. Unapologetically doesn't tell you a single thing. It expects you to sit there and figure things out. And we're going to explain to you the theories behind this using our big brains, our knowledge of the franchise, and the Murkoff accounts, which provides, still to this day, to be the best source of tying the Outlast series together.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Right, so we can go back now. We can take the pin out
take
of the tower.
Out.
So the radio tower, okay, this isn't explained in the game, but the radio
once again,
tower,
this is the Murkoff accounts.
Murkoff accounts, correct. Is owned by the Murkoff Corporation.
The one and only, boys.
Yeah. This whole settlement, this whole thing is like one giant experiment.
Everything about Temple's Gate, everything to do with it, it's all been a ploy by Murkoff, basically, in order to test something new, a new thing to experiment with.
It's like the second version of the engine that they were using in the first one. And this time, rather than having it through one person, through one host, it's an outward signal cast out by the light that you see coming from the tower that affects everyone.
So every time in the game, Blake goes into his moments in the school is followed by the lights. You always see the lights, the big flash, which the followers refer to as the sun when they see it. That is what is making them go crazy, basically. It's the signals coming from the radio tower, the Murkoff Tower, in the distance of Temple's Gate.
Yeah, bizarre, right? And again, like, I feel like so much could have been explained there within the game, right? Even if it was just a note, even if we just found an attaché case or something, right? But
I think there is a document that explains that the Murkoff Corporation are the cause for it, basically. But it doesn't correctly put two and two together with the radio tower being the source of it.
Yeah,
but it does explain Murkoff's involvement. There is a document you can get in the game which does explain that it's Murkoff's business, basically.
So obviously, like I played the game in one sitting, and I went out of my way to try and find as many notes and as many recordings as I could, and I didn't find that note.
Yeah, there is one in there.
I think you can imagine, right? For somebody that maybe isn't that bothered about finding the notes, or even if somebody like myself who was bothered with finding the notes that didn't find
it's a critical note, right? A critical note.
You would imagine how jarring and how disorienting that would be, right, from a story perspective.
I think it comes a bit after or a bit towards when you find out the secret about Father L and that business.
Yeah.
Just before sort of the final school segments, you sort of learn about Murkoff's involvement in it. And this is obviously corroborated and backed up by the Murkoff accounts, confirming what happens. Now that we know this, obviously, we can go back through the sections and we can start putting bits and bobs together. Basically, Lynn appears visibly pregnant, not correct. Lynn was basically suffering from phantom pregnancy. And this is really interesting because in Outlast 1, take it all the way back, y'all, there's a fantastic note you can find which basically explains something really interesting. It relates heavily to Outlast 2 in that women, female inmates in the Mount Massive Asylum had to be moved further away, which is why the prison, the female wing, is on the other side of the asylum, because radiation from the morphic engine would leak out and it would cause these women to suffer from phantom pregnancies.
Yeah. Basically. Weird, right?
Mm-hmm. And this is a fully full thing in the first game. And this is exactly what's happening at Temple's Gate. Not every single woman there has been pregnant. Some of them have been just suffering from the phantom pregnancies and have then had to, you know, kill themselves, right? Even if they've not been pregnant the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. So, and again, this is it. Unless you're a massive nerd and you know, you don't delve into the deepest lore, this is why I think, and we've mentioned right in the intro that this game is so divisive because of exactly that reason. Mm-hmm. They took it a step further from the first game. The first game, I think, even if you don't get the notes, like you can still piece things together mostly. But this one relies so heavily on those notes and those recordings.
Yeah,
if you don't really get them, you have no idea. You've got no idea.
And that one, obviously, that theory, not only does that come from the second issue of the comic book in which they talk about the phantom pregnancy signals in Mount Massive, but that's also a note in itself in Outlast 1 as well, right? So that's the comic and the first game drawing credence to what's happening in this game. And the phantom pregnancy stuff is even evident in Lynn herself, who suffers from this apparent pregnancy. Obviously, as the player is seeing all sorts going on here. There's no way possible she can have this baby. And even at the end, when she delivers this baby, when this baby gets taken by Blake, she proclaims there's nothing there before dying. And what is really interesting, this is proper attention to detail, yeah? You miss if you don't see this. If you look at the baby Blake's holding, if you look underneath Blake, the baby's model doesn't cast a shadow.
Yeah.
Blake's hands, right. The shadow of Blake, his hands are empty. They're not holding a baby.
Yeah, yeah. And like I mentioned, there's no umbilical cord, right, as well?
So no umbilical cord, right, either. So there's no umbilical cord.
How is that possible?
No shadow. Yeah. And at the very end, when the sun swallows the world, Blake puts both his hands up. And there's no child in his hand. No one there. Look at that, right? So at the end itself, right, you are even brought in to the madness yourself, and you have no idea what's going on. You don't know as the player, you don't know what to believe. You don't know if it's real, you don't know if it's fake, you don't know if it's, you know, you don't know if you're going crazy as well, right? You've got no idea. You've got no idea what's going on.
However, there are a few indicators that you are given, with the recordings, right, as towards the end. When you're actually recording the events of the storm happening and so on and so forth, if you actually listen to the commentary that he kind of does over the top of the video, it's very interesting because he's not actually talking about Lynn.
No.
He says the words like, we're in trouble here. Me and Jessica just need to go and find an adult.
Mm. Yeah.
He's talking like he's a child and he's with Jessica, not Lynn.
He almost reverts back to a childlike state when he was dealing with Father L back in the school after his, you know, brushes with this morphogenic engine 2.0. Murkoff have made, it kind of reverts Blake back to his childlike state. Like you said, it's very interesting. Yeah. If you watch his recordings back, Blake's commentary, he is commentating it like he's a child, basically.
Yeah.
You know, his commentary is like he's a child.
Yeah. And any recordings that you make while you're in the school segments are just static when you watch them back.
Yep.
And there are voices within the recording, but they're in reverse. Mm-hmm. So you can't understand what they're saying.
Very clever, right? So all those sections aren't even there. So that's another thing which gives you that kind of, this isn't real vibe, this isn't real. But you get so sucked in, you just lose track of what's real, what isn't real. and it's fantastic. I think it's fantastic storytelling, but it's very divisive because it's not direct storytelling. It's not forward direct storytelling. And ironically, this is a topic that's being debated very heavily at the moment in gaming and gaming news, with the Game Awards ceremony that's coming out very soon, actually in December, because there's a massive battle between Game of the Year and Best Narrative Game, and God of War Ragnarok and Elden Ring are kind of at each other's throats for this, and the fans are rabid over it, because some of the fans believe that Elden Ring, for example, doesn't deserve a Best Narrative Award because its narrative works very similar to Dark Souls and very similar to Outlast 2, in that it doesn't tell you the things straight up. It gives you bits and bobs, but then it expects you to do some due diligence and to look at stuff yourself. And I think it's definitely a very interesting, but it can be a very jarring storytelling method. But I think personally it's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, I think if I can speak about my experience, I could definitely say that I absolutely enjoyed the game. I did. Like, I enjoyed it from start to finish. It's one I will definitely go back and play again.
Mm. I would like to play it again because I've only played it like once or maybe even twice. I've honestly not played Outlast 2 very much at all.
Yeah. But what I will also say is that I can completely understand where a lot of people were coming from when they said, man, I just didn't get it. Like, what the hell? What the hell was this? Like, by comparison, I can understand why so many people preferred the first one over the second one.
The storyline for the first one is a lot more cut and dry, isn't it? Right, it's a lot more out there, a lot more open, and the whistleblower DLC, like we said last time, right, does a fantastic job of tying up the package in a neat little bow.
It does. Yeah, that's it. Whereas I think people don't like unanswered questions, and I feel like two does a really good job of leaving you wanting. It gives you that kind of feeling of like, I've got so many questions and I can't get my answers now, right?
Exactly.
Unless, of course, you go and have a look at the Murkoff accounts.
Right.
So as an individual experience, it's very frustrating. But overall, what it contributes to the Outlast universe, with everything that we have, it fits perfectly and it does a great job.
It does
exactly what it's supposed to.
It does a perfect job. It's just, at its core value, you just do not understand it. You have to go and actually look yourself and find these answers, which I like it. It's not everyone's cup of tea, but I like this storytelling method, you know, because I'm a massive nerd. I love digging through lore and stuff like that, right? I love reading things. So for me, it's perfect, right? I understand it's not everyone's cup of tea. And to clear up the final massive kind of plot hole that people have with the game, what the hell is ending about? Did the world actually end? No, it did not. Obviously, the sun, or what we think is the sun, comes and takes over, you know, Blake completely. That's not actually the sun. That is actually the Murkoff Tower once again, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it.
It's the tower itself.
It's all an hallucination. Mm-hmm. But it's not one of those crappy endings where, like, and it was all a dream.
No, it all happened. It's just they obviously saw what never really properly happened.
Distorted, right? So, yeah, the cult still happened.
The cult still happened.
Probably 80-90% of everything that happens within
it all happened. Yeah, it was just, it was pushed and it was pulled by this morphogenic engine 2.0, really. So the final explosion at the end, and the reason why everything is going crazy, is because the actual radio tower malfunctions and breaks down, doesn't it? It falls and breaks down, and in the last issue of the Murkoff accounts, it's shown that the station is actually taken apart by ants. That ants, for some reason, this is where it starts to get a little bit crazy, are linked to the War Rider.
Because the War Rider can obviously it can take a host from almost anything. So again, if you read those Murkoff accounts, you can find out that the War Rider actually jumps several hosts. So
it does,
the last we saw of it was Miles Upshur. But it's actually jumped several times, including the guy who it's the guy that talks to.
Yes, it is the at the end of the whistleblower, isn't it?
I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but the War Rider even jumps to that guy because he goes missing. Nobody knows where he is. Obviously, last time anybody sees him is Wayland Park when he submits the form.
He's the guy standing over him, like, you know, Murkoff has the power to, like, you know, end you if you do this.
Yeah, even jumps to that guy at one point, and then it jumps to this swarm of ants, and it's actually the War Rider that takes apart the tower. So again, it's another solid link to the first game but only accessible through
exactly
external media.
And that one bit there explains a lot of what happens at the end of the game. All of the apocalypse events that everyone's seeing and stuff, yeah, that is all brought about because the tower is malfunctioning, basically, and people aren't getting the doses in the correct amount because originally the tower was meant to provide doses, obviously, in concentrated amounts at times, yeah, and he would monitor what happened after it. But because of this malfunction, the tower goes crazy and skits before it cuts out, and that's where everyone goes nuclear, basically, in terms of craziness. Yeah. And our man Blake is also explained, and what happens to Blake is shown at the end of his comic as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
A Murkoff team that we've not seen called the Murkoff Insurance Mitigation Department, which is an interesting name, arrive on the scene, obviously, of Temple's Gate to kind of clear up the mess. And they find Blake there, basically, in a catatonic state. And obviously no baby at all. So that fully confirms that there was no babies. It was the engine the whole time. And they are basically like, we're going to take him in because he's the only person who's here. And we're going to research off him, basically.
And he's got a full account on his camera.
Exactly, yeah. So sadly, Blake, he doesn't get a very good ending at all. Like, he ends up in a catatonic state because it's largely believed that that end sequence with Jessica again, where he's in the room, his mind is just stuck in there, basically, with her. Like, that's his existence now. Like, he's been broken down so much by the radio tower that he is just in this catatonic state and he's forever stuck in that room with Jessica, basically.
Yeah. It's like a waking coma almost, isn't it, for him?
So
the tower suddenly shutting off just completely fries everyone that's been exposed to it. Mm-hmm. And it's also worth mentioning as well that, because obviously there would probably be questions in and around, well, why didn't Lynn see the baby? She's been exposed to the engine as well, but she spent so long underground.
Yeah, she was down in deep in the mines,
from the flashes,
with the heretics, because that is a thing. Actually, it doesn't state Lynn's death. Obviously, Lynn didn't die from childbirth. The comics say that she just died from trauma, basically. So we're assumed that she was stabbed or attacked, basically, in the riot that happened in the mines, or during the escape when Martha was potentially chasing them. Maybe she was attacked then and died.
Yeah, also worth mentioning, I don't believe that we see Val die either.
No, not really. She sort of does some weirdness with Blake in the mines before the riot. But during the riot, she sort of like, it's never really explained what happens to her.
Some of the mines collapse, so obviously we can assume that there were some lives lost from within that.
Potentially,
but I don't actually see Val die. So
once again,
part of me that thinks that she might actually still be alive.
There's potential for that, yeah. Like we said, at the start, right, Val's a very interesting character, and a lot of her lore is only explained through the books in the game.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's a lot more that they could possibly do there, or they could have done a lot more maybe to explain more of her past, Perhaps even a DLC they could have done would be playing her. When she still had a sense about her, right? And ending maybe as she becomes the cult leader.
Yeah, that would have been quite an interesting concept to explore.
Because I think that probably would have maybe given a bit more credence to the character and a bit more background to the heretics as a group as well. Because you're sort of introduced to them very kind of slapdash, aren't you? Very ad hoc. They come in and they kind of mess shit up for Noth, and you're expected to kind of understand that, oh yeah, there's a bit of a civil war going on here, isn't there?
Yeah, you are very much kind of thrust into the middle of it, aren't you? So because we do have an Outlast 3 on the way at some point, if it follows suit with the previous two, this is probably going to seem completely unrelated, so we may not ever get to...
We don't know at all.
We may never get any closure with Val's story as well, which is kind of a shame.
It is a shame, also, yeah. But that's the only character I could really say there is a bit of a plot hole to in Outlast 2, because everything else is neatly tied up. If not in Outlast 2, it's tied up in Murkoff accounts.
Yeah, yeah.
A little interesting tidbit to go on as well. I think what we'll probably do is, I really want to talk about Outlast Trials a bit more as well, but we're already kind of coming up to a bit of a long one here. So I think what we might do is either do a slightly reduced part three, or maybe we'll pick it up in a newsreel, perhaps, talking about our time with Outlast Trials, if you think that's a good idea, my man.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be good.
So a little tidbit of Easter egg maybe for you. When you come out of the church at the end, and you see everyone dead and everyone's poisoned themselves, this is actually a relation to a real life incident that happened, known as the Jonestown incident, which happened a little while ago now, back in 1978, I believe it was, of a remote settlement, basically, of a man that owned it called Jim Jones. He made this settlement, basically, in, where was it? It was in South America somewhere. He basically made this settlement called Jonestown, and it was a people's Christian-based cult, basically, that he made. And it became extremely famous because in November the 18th, 1978, a total of 909 people in this settlement all poisoned themselves, basically killed themselves under his command. You know, the entire cult basically drank this poisoned Kool-Aid and killed themselves. And that is directly related and kind of linked to the end of Outlast 2. It's like an Easter egg.
That is really interesting, yeah. And it's great how they have drawn so much. I say it's great. It's not great at all.
The Jonestown story is very tragic, very interesting though. If you're into true crime, you're into kind of that kind of history. There's a lot of good podcasts and a lot of good YouTube videos and documentaries about it. Totally urge you guys to watch it if you're curious.
But what I would say is that I appreciate the reference. Mm. You know, the kind of. And a lot of the references they make, you know, even like the biblical stuff, I think is really fantastic.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of real life influence that have come into this game, both from religion and both from real life cults as well. Obviously, the Jonestown incident. There's another famous cult called Heaven's Gate you might have heard of as well.
Right.
That's almost a direct link to Temple Gate in terms of names. That was also a cult that, in the end, a lot of the cultists end up killing themselves, basically, like ritual suicide type thing. That one was kind of wild because the guys that killed themselves were wearing a certain type of shoe, like a Nike shoe. It was like a certain brand new Nike shoe. Until this day, Nike have never remade the shoe again.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Wow.
And a bit dark and morbid, people online, shoe collectors online, pay big money for those shoes. Very morbid, but interesting. They pay massive money for those shoes. What's even creepier actually about the Heaven's Gate guys, I think it is they still have a website today, which you can visit. You can still listen to all their stuff on that website as well. And they still have an active email address that's maintained by three members of the cult that are still alive.
Madness.
And they will even send you their book if you send them money.
Wow.
How fucking mental is that?
That is mental.
That is mad, mate. But that's the madness of Outlast 2, my dude. It was a very interesting game. It takes so much inspiration from the first game and then kind of flips it on its head, doesn't it? And provides the player with a very different environment. And for the longest time, actually, it sort of makes the player believe that it's actually supernatural horror and not physical horror in this one.
Yeah. And I think that's the ultimately what makes Outlast 2 so clever is the fact that it presents a completely different experience, but it is the same. It's so similar to the first one, but you just don't see it until you actually sit down and think about it. So many comparisons that we've already drawn, you know, similarities in certain scenes in the game and things that happen. You know, it's almost a parallel, isn't it, to its earlier cousin?
It really is, dude. It really is, and it's just I like to think that, you know, like we said, if you hadn't played the game, I'd recommend giving it a shot, giving both games a shot. It's a very interesting horror series, very interesting horror universe. And when playing that second game, I think it's best to go in with an open mind and not necessarily read what you see online, because a lot of people online have bashed Outlast 2 mercilessly, but most of those people I've seen that have bashed it, I think have failed to grasp the concept of the story or have done research further into the story. You know, because like you said, Zach, if you take this story from a face value, you will probably not get a lot out of it at all.
No, absolutely not.
But if you play the first game, you play the DLC, you do a bit of due diligence, you check out the Murkoff accounts, read half of them, and then stop, play the game, then read the other half, because obviously the end of the accounts does kind of spoil the events of the second game. I think you'll have a much clearer kind of look, and it will be way... You'll love it a lot more, won't you?
Yes, yeah. I completely agree. And... If you have played the games but you haven't checked out the Murkoff accounts, I would highly recommend it. It's a 100% good read.
Yeah. Like we said, it's really, really hard to get them in physical editions anymore because you don't sell them, but you can read them all on the Red Barrels website for free as well, which is really good.
Yeah, so thank you ever so much, everybody, for listening to us going about Outlast 2. Yeah, a shame that we weren't able to cover Outlast Trials today.
No,
that's
no.
Absolutely fine, because there will be another episode on the way, and
100%.
We will talk through. It's obviously a little bit out of date now. It was a little while ago that we played it, but it's still fresh in our mind. We enjoyed it a lot.
100%. So. It's still fresh. I feel like that would be a good one. What we're doing that one, everyone, is we're having a little chat about the business. We're maybe recap a bit of the kind of Outlast story so far, and then we'll talk a bit about Trials and maybe about the third game as well, because there's not a lot about the third game, but it is interesting, and it was announced actually technically in 2017.
Wow. Yeah.
But there's been zero anything since then, no time frame, no nothing, other than it's apparently happening.
It might be worth us maybe having a little talk about some theories. Maybe we can theorize about what we expect we'll see from Outlast.
It'd be like a 0.5 par, like a 2.5 edition.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, thank you ever so much, everyone, for listening to us ramble once again about a fantastic horror series we absolutely adore, Outlast 2. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you all so much, everyone. Take care, and we'll see you very soon.
Bye.